Welcome to the Midday for a Friday. I'm Norman Gilliland, and as promised, we have live music for you today. We'll also, of course, have the quiz question at 12:30. That's right here, ready to go. And today being Friday, we'll have a treasure trove for somebody who gets the question right today, or gets the answer to the question right. Live music comes today, well, comes to us from Chicago via musicians who hail from that way of late. Violinist Heather Whittles and pianist Craig Terry, welcome to the Midday.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Fun to have you here. And it's always fun looking at performer bios because there are these long lists of, wow, you know, played everywhere in the world with all kinds of people. But in your case, it's a little different because you sort of wear different hats, too. In Heather's case, you have served as a concertmaster of many orchestras, including the New World Symphony, which is one that I come across from time to time, performers who have worked with that, and the Spoleto Festival Orchestra, Pacific Music Festival, and the Chicago Beethoven Festival Orchestra, etc. And you're more or less permanently, though, attached to the Chicago Lyric Orchestra, right?
That's right. I just finished my fourth season in the Chicago Lyric Opera Orchestra.
And so there's a season for that, though, right?
Yes, the season runs from September until the beginning of April.
Pretty much like the Met?
Mm-hmm. They go a little longer, I think.
And so what do you do then in the off-season?
Well, for 10 weeks of the summer, I'm the associate concertmaster at the Glimmerglass Opera Festival in Cooperstown, New York.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I also spend time doing chamber music with people like Craig. And performing in other small projects in Chicago and in other places.
And so do you have a favorite opera that you like to play? I mean, as a violinist? We don't think about it that way too much, do we?
No, I've always come to opera as a fan first and as a violinist second. So I have many favorite operas to watch. This season, we opened with Elektra by Richard Strauss, and that's a favorite to watch and to play for me.
And what makes it fun to play?
It's a very involving orchestral score. It's very fully orchestrated. Yeah, everyone has something
Strauss
to do.
Strauss for you, yeah.
Yes.
Kept everybody busy, didn't he?
Yeah, and it's one of those pieces that the 15th time you play it, you still are hearing things you haven't heard before. It's all so interconnected that the more you listen, the more rewarding it becomes, and that's really fun to work on.
And what sense of the opera do you have when you're down there in the pit, right?
Well, you can't see.
Yeah, you can't see what's going on. You might see a foot or something occasionally jutting off the front of the stage.
Yes, and you hear the audience reaction. You hear gasps of horror, and you hear laughter.
And you don't know exactly what it's all about. It's kind of like radio that way.
It is. I always try to know the opera beforehand so I know what's funny or what's sad or at least the story. But I like to know what's going on in each scene because it changes the way you play it as a musician. You want to bring all of the character to the music just as the actors do on stage.
Well, Craig, we'll get to you later. Speaking of conductors and opera, because you do conduct opera.
Well, occasionally. Okay, very occasionally.
And we'll get into that, as I say, a little bit later, but you have a nice variety of things lined up for us today, starting with the composer who is sometimes considered the greatest violinist who ever lived, and perhaps the greatest violinist who ever could live, by some accounts, was he even human, Paganini. But here, he's not exactly, at least the title implies that he's not exactly setting the world on fire. This is a more subdued lyrical piece, cantabile, singing. And what attracts you about this piece?
Well, it is a very vocal piece. The violin part could easily be an aria. But I actually came to this piece, I had never heard of it, and my boyfriend, Christopher, who is a cellist, played this piece for me, played me a YouTube video of it, and said, I love this piece. You should play it. So I learned it on the sly, and I surprised his entire family with it at Christmas as a present. And that's how I came to this piece. I absolutely love it. He was right. It was exactly the kind of thing that I enjoy listening to and playing.
Do you suppose it was one of those pieces he wrote originally for violin and guitar, or where does it come from?
We were debating that. Different sources seem to differ on whether he wrote it for violin and guitar or violin and piano. It seems clear he wrote both versions of the accompaniment, but it is frequently done with guitar.
All right, here with violin and piano, Cantabile by Paganini, Heather Whittles, and Craig Terry. Some pretty Paganini, the Cantabile. You started playing, Heather, you started playing the violin at the age of 3. Now, how did that come about? Obviously, your parents had something to do with it, but how do parents know or suspect that their child is violin material at the age of 3? Did you show any talent in some way?
No, that one was simple. My mother had still has a very good friend that she's known since kindergarten, who became a Suzuki violin teacher. So she came to visit us with a very small violin
like because a 1/8 or something.
Actually, it was a 30-second size.
30 seconds.
I still have it. It is adorable.
It'd be easy to lose, wouldn't it?
Yes, it's very small. But she brought it along, and let me play with it, and asked if I liked playing with it, and then told my mother to get me lessons, and gave her the name of a teacher. But I actually didn't even start on the violin. I started on a little box of greeting cards with a dowel. Because a three-year-old is pretty clumsy, and you have to teach them to treat a violin carefully. So we start with a fake violin.
I guess I can see there would be some advantage that you could go through a lot of those little violins
exactly.
That way, couldn't you?
Yes. So I did the Suzuki method, and I started learning very little. And they also teach you to sing and clap rhythms and to listen and repeat. You learn by rote initially.
I was going to ask, at what point do you actually start reading from a score?
Yeah, much later. I don't remember. I was quite little then, too, but there were years of listening and repeating, which I think is a great skill for all musicians to have.
I would say you never know when you'll be called upon to play without music,
mm-hmm.
without a score. And then your, typical isn't quite the right word, but it's not at all unusual to see this educational combination among fine musicians. That is to say, your undergraduate degree at Yale was in chemistry.
Yes, it was.
Well, you had presumably, you already had close to 20 years of musical training at that point. What prompted you to go into chemistry?
Well, I had been playing the violin my whole life, and I did play throughout my undergraduate. I took lessons, I played in the orchestra at Yale, I did chamber music. But when I got out of high school, I wasn't sure if I wanted to do music as a career. I wasn't sure what that even meant. My parents are both scientists, and I didn't know a lot of people who'd gone into music professionally who hadn't come from a musical family, I guess. So I wasn't sure what that meant or what it would entail, and I liked science, so I thought I should try to do both as long as possible and make up my mind later.
Yeah,
and that's what I did. I made up my mind senior year of college to apply to music school.
Pretty common, too. There was just something there by the end of your undergraduate career that said music is the way to go.
Yes. I think as I grew up a little bit, I started to enjoy the process of practicing much more. I was quite impatient with it in high school. I liked to play, and I practiced up to a point. But then it just seemed very repetitive, which it is.
Yes.
But by the time I was 20 or 21, the repetitive parts started to become more interesting. And the nuance of working things out at a very minute level appealed to me more.
Well, we're going to hear another piece in just a moment. This time we're going to go to Mozart, but we'll do that shortly after this on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Sundays from 10 to noon, it's the Sunday Brunch, a special blend of music to accompany your Sunday routine. I'm Anders Yoakum. This week's Sunday treats from Mendelssohn, Gershwin, Chris Brubeck, and others. 10 to noon Sunday on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for WPR comes from UW Health Radiology, offering 3D virtual colonoscopy to screen for colorectal cancer, now available at 3 Madison locations. More at uwhealth.org/radiology. Support also comes from Overture Center for the Arts, presenting See, the Mind-Blowing Circus, a juxtaposition of insomnia, amnesia, and paranoia with the life-affirming language of circus arts, April 20th and 21st. Tickets at OvertureCenter.com.
Welcome back to The Midday. I'm Norman Gilliland with violinist Heather Wittels and pianist Craig Terry up from Chicago, both of them musicians down there in a big way, a big versatile way. Of course, they play all around the country and around the world, too. And they have for us now some Mozart. Mozart, of course, was, he could play all kinds of instruments, among them the violin and the viola. And I gather that he wrote this sonata for his own performing as well as for others. And it's a sonata in B-flat. Do you know offhand, Heather or Craig, where this falls in his chronology of composing?
I'm guessing somewhere
in the middle, but what do we find in the first movement of this sonata? I mean, Mozart, of course, is this wonderful singing quality so much that he did. We think of that usually as really coming to the fore in the slow movement of a piece. Well, this is going to be more up-tempo. What's going to happen?
It's very typical in its compositional style. I mean, it's, you know, basic sonata form, two themes that go in and out, and what's interesting to me about it is that he titles it Sonata for Piano and Violin. These are,
oh, really?
They're not sonatas for violin and piano, at least in the way that he composed them,
that
he titled them.
You're getting top billing here.
So, yeah, which never happens. So we have to enjoy it while we can. But in that way, it's lovely how we pass the tune back and forth, and sometimes it changes during the course of it. Sometimes I play the entire tune, sometimes I play only half, sometimes I play none of it. And we sort of, not haphazardly, but it's different each time, which I think is interesting and somewhat different than a lot of music written in the same compositional style.
Okay, here we go. This is the first movement of the Sonata in B-flat by Mozart. Thank you. wow, weren't we all having fun with that? Lots of smiling going. And I have to admit, beautiful as Heather's playing is, that I was sort of hoping, Craig, that you would run away with it with a cadenza of your own right at the end there, just kind of steal the show.
Well, you know, he didn't write one there.
And then back we go to Heather Wattels and Craig Terry, violin and piano, respectively, with some folk dances. But not just any folk dances, from a collector of folk dances. There were several of those in the early 20th century who had lugged this heavy recording equipment around the continent. In particular, Percy Grainger was one. I think Zoltán Kodály did some of that in Hungary. And so did Béla Bartók. And what have you come up with? Bartók arranged his for various combinations, but I suppose most frequently for violin and piano.
Well, he actually wrote these five Romanian folk dances. He transcribed them and he wrote them for piano alone. But this violinist, Zoltán Sekely, forgive my pronunciation, who was a Hungarian violinist of great renown and who worked with Bartók on his violin concerto, in fact, gave the premiere of it, he arranged the five dances for violin and piano. And I think he changed the key of two of them to make them sit better on the violin. And he added some extended techniques, some pizzicato, some false harmonics.
Give the violinist something to do.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And I think to give more flavor of what the dances would have sounded like in their original instrumentation, perhaps.
There was a lot of dance music of that kind that influenced composers. I mean, again, back to Kodály and his Galanta dances. I mean, he heard a gypsy band playing when he was a kid, and that years later turned into one of his major orchestral works. So here we are with, how many of them are there?
There are five.
Five?
Six, actually, but five and six are joined at the hip. They don't have a break between them.
Okay, here they are. Romanian Folk Dances by Bartók. Bravo. Those were Romanian folk dances by Béla Bartók with some arrangement. How do you accomplish those harmonics, Heather? I couldn't quite tell from here.
So false harmonics. You have one finger down on the string hard, the way you normally make a note, and you have another finger, which is a fourth higher, very lightly touching the string.
Easy to say.
Right, and because you're anchoring the bottom finger, you can move it anywhere, and you can make any note sound as a harmonic. Natural harmonics, you know, only occur at certain intervals
right,
of the string length.
Like an octave, yeah.
Right, or half the string, a quarter of the string, where the nodes are. But with a false harmonic, because you're moving the length of the string with your bottom finger, you're changing the length there, you can make the harmonic sound anywhere, theoretically.
Back with Heather Littells and Craig Terry right after this on Wisconsin Public Radio. Back with Heather Littells, violin, and Craig Terry, piano. And speaking of piano, your teacher, Warren Jones, was on this program about, let's see, it would have been about 6 years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
fantastic.
Charming, charming guy.
He's wonderful. We were, you know, when I auditioned for him at Manhattan School of Music, you know, back in the 1900s, I started to play and I heard lots of laughter from the back of the room. And as it turned out, I found out that Warren and another faculty member and I all share the same birthday.
No kidding.
And so, Warren and I are both from small towns in the South.
I was going to say, you sound kind of like Warren.
I know. People tell me that a lot. But he's one of my dearest friends. We speak very often, and he's a wonderful pianist and mentor.
And someone else that you have worked with was here yesterday, Susanna Phillips.
Oh, fantastic,
She's
Susanna.
Performing with the Wisconsin Chamber Orchestra tonight.
Get out, really?
Yes,
fantastic.
Indeed, so small musical world.
Oh, she's great. She, too, is from the South. So we have...
Well, that's right, from Alabama. We got into that a little bit yesterday.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you... Do you think of yourself primarily as a conductor or primarily as a pianist?
Primarily as a pianist, I would say. Mm-hmm. I mean, I love, you know, occasionally I get the opportunity. A couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to conduct the student matinees of Elixir of Love at Lyric, which was lots of fun. But in general, as a performer, you know, it's like 98% pianist, you know, 2% conductor.
But assistant conductor at the Met?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I finished, I did my training there after I finished... my master's, they invited me to go and spend 2 years there as an apprentice. They have a program for apprentice coaches and pianists. And so we got to work very closely with Maestro Levine and with wonderful artists and singers and pianists and coaches. And it was a wonderfully rich part of my training.
How about this Brahms that you're about to play? Rumor has it you have good things to say about it.
I don't know. I think it's my favorite of the three. I have to say, I do love it. And one of this program, as it was put together, there are many things that have a foot in the vocal world. I mean, there are things that, you know, whether they're dances with words, perhaps, or folk songs, or you know, the first piece, the cantabile, all things that are vocal in nature. And Brahms uses a very beautiful melody. Actually, it's from his song called "Wie Melodien sieht es mir." As the second theme of this, so for me, I even think that Brahms thinks of it as a vocal piece in this particular style. So it's what sort of, I don't know, has always drawn me to it.
Here's the first movement from it, the Brahms Sonata in A.
Thank you.
Now, another one of those great showstoppers, isn't it? That's just the first movement, of course, of the Brahms Violin Sonata in A, one of three violin sonatas that he wrote. He wrote that for, obviously, a particular violinist. Which one? Do you remember? Was it Joachim, or was it one of the other luminaries
sure.
of the day?
He did collaborate with Joachim a great deal, including on his concerto. They sent letters back and forth with revisions. But I don't know if he worked with him on the sonatas.
You're giving us good homework.
Yeah, that's right. Go back and research that, and we'll get that figured out. I should mention, in terms of collaboration, too, one thing I didn't point out was that Heather performs with the Token Creek Chamber Music Festival. How many times? Once? Twice?
I performed once.
Just the one one time with that ensemble that John and Rosemary Harbison put together each year out at the farm on Token Creek. Well, musically, we're pretty much there, actually. And so I'd like to thank you for coming in and look forward to upcoming performances. Now, I know the Chicago Lyric is done.
Yes, although we're doing a production of Oklahoma this year.
Oh, the Lyric is. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's right.
Yep.
And I'm playing for that.
And what will you be doing, Craig, for that? Or anything else, for that matter?
I'm not doing that. But a little plug, I'm actually playing a show that will be aired on PBS on live from Lincoln Center next Friday night.
No kidding.
So if anybody wants to watch, it's a tribute to Kate Smith that Stephanie Blythe and I do. And anyway, it's next Friday. Check your local listings on PBS. So that's my future thing.
And I've seen the show, and it's fantastic.
So this is a show you've done before, obviously. How did you discover Kate Smith? Not too many people would remember her today.
Well, Stephanie, she had always wanted to do that as a pet project. And so she asked me if I'd be interested in putting together a program. So we did it 2 years ago for the first time. We've probably done it 20 times now. And they brought us back to record it for television this past February.
Well, Kate had some big hits to her credit.
She sure did.
So there'd be some great tunes in there. Well, break some legs with that. Thanks. That's, you say, next Friday night?
Next Friday night.
Week from tonight on PBS.
Exactly.
All right, look for that. Thanks again for being with us today, Heather Wittels and Craig Terry.
It's our pleasure.
Thank you so much for having us.
And thanks also to our engineer, Brittany True, to our piano technician, Lyle Hirons, and also to Nola Mills and Lori Skelton. This is WPR.